the judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Bryce C. Harris, miscellaneous docket number 2020-07. I note that today's argument is being conducted under the current COVID-19 pandemic mandates from the Department of Defense and other relevant authorities. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judge abused his discretion in his application of the Military Rule of Evidence 503 to exclude evidence of appellee's communications. Appellate's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 6 minutes.
You may proceed.
Senior Judge Posh, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Jessica Delaney, and along with Colonel Sean Speranza, I represent the government today's proceeding. Your Honors, the court-martial has as its primary function a truth-seeking function. And it is this general fundamental principle that the government and the public have access to every man's evidence, which should guide the court in its deliberations. Notably, the Supreme Court has acknowledged that certain privileges are exempted out from this general principle. But because of this fundamental need for the court to exercise truth-seeking, those privileges must be strictly and narrowly construed. And the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has similarly noted that military judges, in exercising their authority under the Military Rules of Evidence, are to apply only the express terms of those rules, and not to engage in the policy-making determinations, which are the province of the policy-making branches of the government. It is this fundamental principle which the military judge in this case misunderstood, which led to his numerous abuses of discretion in the case. This court should look to three specific examples in which the military judge abused his discretion. First, in his erroneous finding that the appellee in this case had made the communications as a formal act of religion and as a matter of conscience. Second, the military judge abused his discretion when he found that the communications in this case were confidential. And finally, the military judge abused his discretion in protecting and precluding a statement that appellee made to a minor victim, rather than looking simply to communications made solely to the chaplain in this case. The military judge's misunderstanding of the requirement that he strictly construe the clergy person privilege is most evident in his abuse of discretion on the matter of finding that appellee's communication was a formal act of religion. In United States v. Shelton, our Superior Court has stated that a formal act of religion is one which complies with the particular tenets of a faith. Yet within this case, no evidence was introduced as to what religion or faith was practiced during this group meeting. Appellee did not testify as to what denomination he belonged to. The chaplain did not testify as to what denomination she belonged to. There was no evidence that the father-in-law, mother-in-law, or sister-in-law of appellee practiced the same faith that he did. In addition to Shelton's acknowledgement of what constitutes a formal act of religion, this court may also be guided by the historic basis behind the clergy person privilege. And that was recognized by the Supreme Court in Trammell, in which the court noted that the privilege is constrained to the need to disclose to a spiritual counselor in total and absolute confidence what are believed to be flawed acts or thoughts and to receive priestly consolation in return. In addition to failing to identify what faith was being practiced, there's no evidence as to what particular tenet of a faith was involved. Instead, the military judge simply concluded, without evidence, that he was practicing a formal act of religion when he engaged in group counseling. rather than looking to evidence, because the standard at trial was that appellee had to produce and prove by a preponderance of the evidence, not mere argument, but evidence that he was practicing a formal act of religion. The military judge did not hold him to that threshold standard, but made a conclusory finding. The military judge also...
What are the issues that I wish you could touch on? And you did there as well, the conclusory finding aspect of this. And this privilege has seldom been interpreted. It's rather novel in some respects. We have the Shelton case. But part of what we have to do in an opinion that we would author is decide whether this is a question of fact or a question of law. And I recall from your brief that you seem to bin a lot of these as questions of law. What are your thoughts as to whether this is in fact a question of fact versus a question of law, for example, the formal act of religion or the matter of conscience, which I'm sure you're going to get to?
So, Your Honor, it's both. It's a mixed question. And in looking at formal act of the religion, it's easy for this court to see how it is a mixed question. Evidence would be, for instance, had the appellee stated that he was practicing the formal act of penance, there would be a legal conclusion as to whether the act of penance could constitute a formal act of religion, but there would also be a finding of fact as to whether he was actually practicing that act and whether the totality of the circumstances demonstrated that he had met that legal standard. So the interpretation of the terminology, the interpretation of the words in Military Rule of Evidence 503 is the application of law. Whether appellee produced the evidence to support meeting that application of law is then the finding of fact in the case.
Thank you.
Moving on to the matter of conscience, again, Shelton provides us some guidance. In Shelton, the Court of Appeals held that a matter of conscience is a matter privately held within a person. And it also cited the standard in United States v. Moreno, the Army case, which drew again upon that definition from Trammell and from the Supreme Court. A matter disclosed about flawed thoughts or evils done in search of spiritual guidance and absolution.
Counsel, I got a question on matter of conscience, because this is kind of where I've honed in on this case, really. There's no definition of matter of conscience. It's not defined by the MRE. It's not defined in UCMJ. And there's really no case law that really goes into what this means. And so when you have formal act of religion, which appears to be more objective, seems like the matter of conscience portion is far more subjective. Is there anything that you can propose or guide us to kind of parse out this issue of matter of conscience, of how we should kind of define it, other than just this notion of a privately held belief?
Well, and Your Honor, that's where we combine that Trammell definition and Caff's language that's a privately held belief in seeking to absolve oneself or to redeem oneself with his spiritual advisor. The court repeatedly in Shelton looks to the fact that he sought to spiritually unburden himself and that he was specifically seeking that spiritual guidance from his counselor, and the counselor believed that the confession was necessary for that sort of redemption. So it's tied to that same historical basis under the privilege to disclose wrongs done and seek guidance. That's a matter of conscience. And Kath has told us, perhaps more helpfully to this court, what a matter of conscience is not. So while stating a privately held matter is not, fair to say it's slightly ambiguous, the court has provided guidance as to what is not a matter of conscience, and that's an emotional unburdening. Seeking emotional support is not a matter of conscience.
Well, in this case, the military judge specifically found that there was no emotional unburdening. Correct?
Well, Your Honor, he found that the purpose was to resolve the family matters, to get it out in the open, and to move on. He did not find that appellee himself was seeking spiritual unburdening. You are correct. He did not find the adverse, but he did not make that finding. In Shelton, the court also stated that secular discussions of family finances, budgeting, and personal family matters are not subject to the privilege. So even in Shelton, which is the most on-point case before this court, the court acknowledged that his previous discussions on those three topics were secular and the privilege did not apply to them. So it's against this backdrop of it's not enough that he's seeking consolation from the family. It's not enough that he's seeking understanding from the family. In Coleman, Kaff said that's not a matter of conscience. Emotional support in Napoleon, not a matter of conscience. And in Shelton, guidance on personal family matters is a secular portion. And most importantly, most critically in this case, are Apelli's own statements and his own testimony and the military judge's finding of fact as to the purpose of Apelli's communication. And that purpose was not to disclose wrongs done to a spiritual advisor. It was not to seek guidance on spiritual unburdening. Instead, Apelli testified the purpose was for the entire family to get past the issue, to get his relationship with his wife back on track, and to save his marriage. No mention of feeling guilt. No mention of feeling burdened. No mention of a need to obtain some sort of redemption or absolution from a spiritual advisor. Instead, Apelli's purpose was essentially family and marital counseling. And that is language which appears nowhere.
Counsel, your point is well taken. But there is a question I have. The Apelli does make a statement in the record to the extent of he wanted to get the relationship back on track and having the guidance from a chaplain in being able to do that. And that's similar to what his ex-wife had said, which is that I think she wanted a religious perspective. So how does your argument square with the desire to get a religious perspective, if that's in fact a finding of fact?
Well, and Your Honor, that goes back again to this basic principle that the privilege does not protect all religious communications. It protects only two. There are multiple times in the record when either Apelli or his wife mentioned that there are religious purposes to the meeting. But that is not the purpose stated in the rule. He had to put on evidence that it was a matter of conscience. And when he testified that his purpose was to get his marriage back on track, Apelli failed to meet that burden of a preponderance of the evidence. And the military judge failed to hold him to that. He failed to require some evidence that the Apelli sought spiritual unburdening and advice from the chaplain on his personal feelings of wrongdoing. Instead, he looked at his family members believing that he had done wrong and his need to reconcile with them, which is not within the rule.
So when he sought forgiveness from his sister-in-law, that's really the same thing that you're arguing there. He's not seeking forgiveness from the chaplain, but he's seeking it from the sister-in-law. But to what extent does this court have the authority to, if it's a private matter of his own conscience, to explore his piety or whether seeking absolution or forgiveness from his sister is any different than seeking it from the chaplain or from a god?
Well, Your Honor, that's where the case of Coleman is the closest, in which the Apelli admitted to a family matter to his father-in-law, who was also a clergy person. And the court said, no, that doesn't satisfy the privilege because he's not specifically seeking that guidance from a spiritual advisor, but rather from his father-in-law in the role of a family member. So Coleman has already informed this court, if the communication is to another party for a different purpose than the spiritual guidance from the chaplain, the privilege does not apply. And that dovetails nicely into the next portion of my argument, which addresses the error on the part of the military judge in finding that this was a confidential communication.
Can we go back real quick? So in Coleman, it was a father-in-law, right? But in this case, Apelli actually sought out the chaplain in the sense that his wife was asked, all right, who do you want to go to? They knew Chaplain RD. They had a relationship with her. He agreed to go. This was pretty planned in him going. So he knew exactly what he was going to get by going to go see a chaplain, which is very different than, of course, what was in Coleman, which was different than what was in Napoleon. So How do you resolve that in this case, where there was this notion of, I know why I'm going to this individual? It was very specific on his part.
Yes, Your Honor, and in this case, the purpose of going to the chaplain was for him to speak to his family members. That was the expressed goal of every single family member, that they wanted to air this out, and that was what he stated as well. He wanted to get it out in the open. The military judge found that his desire in this meeting was to get something out in the open, and yet simultaneously found that it was a confidential communication. The rule requires that the statement to the clergy person be confidential. Rather than looking to whether Apelli in this case intended his communication to the chaplain be confidential, the military judge abused his discretion by looking to whether Apelli intended an entire meeting to be confidential. It is clear from the record Apelli never intended his communication to the chaplain to be confidential, and we know that because he brought his father-in-law, he brought his mother-in-law, he brought his sister-in-law, and he brought his wife. And the military judge found that the purpose was to communicate to those third parties. That is not a confidential communication to a clergy person. And no military court has ever found that these types of communications are privileged.
I have a question about the meaning of the phrase purpose of the communication in MRE 503. I'll read the part. It is not intended to be disclosed to third persons other than those to whom disclosure is in furtherance of the purpose of the communication. Is the purpose of the communication in this case the same thing as matter of conscience? Act of religion, or is it for the family to heal, or is it something else? What does that mean, the purpose?
So, Your Honor, within the rule, the purpose of the communication must relate back to what is actually privileged. So it must relate back to the formal act of religion or the matter of conscience. Any other reading would completely eviscerate Military Rule of Evidence 503A, which actually states what the privilege is, and it only protects those communications that are a formal act of religion or a matter of conscience. Now, in this case, the military judge found that the purpose was something other than a matter of conscience when he found, as you noted, Judge Richardson, that the purpose was for this family healing. So he failed to read the rule of evidence in a holistic manner in which every single definition relates back to that initial definition of privilege under 503A. Further, the language in furtherance of the communication. This court has addressed that not within the clergy person privilege explicitly, though I'd like to address how it was dealt with in Shelton, but more specifically in the recent case of Harpole, which was a case on the victim advocate privilege. And CAF noted that the in furtherance language, it was not enough that the appellant in that case personally believed he needed a third party in order to speak with the victim advocate. He believed he needed that person for emotional support. But CAF said it was not enough. His determination that that person was in furtherance was not the appropriate inquiry. Instead, the court looked to the expectation of the victim advocate herself, and did that professional believe a third party presence was in furtherance of the purpose?
So we should be looking at the expectation of the chaplain here?
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly what the court did in Shelton. While it didn't explicitly state that, as the court did in Harpole, that is what happened in that case. It relied upon the fact that the pastor in that case exercised his spiritual authority. And it was the pastor who required Apelli to go and retrieve his wife. And in fact, Apelli, the finding was that Apelli did not, excuse me, the appellant in that case did not want his wife to know what he had told the pastor. That was explicit. That appellant did not want anyone but the pastor to know about what had been said, but the pastor made a determination that his wife's presence was necessary, which is the exact inverse of this case here. There is no evidence that the chaplain believed the family member's presence was necessary. Instead, what's evident is that the family members decided a chaplain's presence, not a chaplain's guidance or advice, but a chaplain's presence was necessary for them to discuss this family matter. And that's evident through the mother-in-law's testimony, who stated that she didn't care if it was a counselor or some other third party. She just believed that they needed someone else to help mediate. And it's evident through the lack of interaction by the chaplain during the meeting. No witness testified that the chaplain drove the discussion in this meeting. Again, unlike Shelton, where the court found that the pastor in that case dominated the meeting and repeatedly brought religion into that meeting. Here, multiple witnesses testified that it was primarily secular, and the only, even Apelli himself testified that the chaplain only interrupted minorly. So there's no evidence from which to infer that the chaplain herself believed third parties were necessary for the transmission of the message or were in furtherance of the purpose of Apelli's communication. And indeed, the military judge provides no logical reasoning behind how the family members were necessary for Apelli to communicate with the chaplain. And because there's no evidence that the chaplain required those third parties, there's similarly no evidence that their presence was in furtherance of his purpose, which must have been a formal act of religion or a matter of conscience. And then finally, the military judge abused his discretion when he found that Apelli communicated statements to the family members, and specifically that Apelli responded to ER, the minor victim in this case, and found that those communications to third parties were privileged, despite the fact that twice within the rule of evidence, it requires that communications be made to a clergy person. And again, no military court has ever held that a communication to a third party in the presence of a professional privilege holder, or in this case, in the presence of a clergy person, authorizes the appellant to invoke the privilege. There is no precedent for that proposition, and this court certainly should not establish any.
How do you address Shelton?
Your Honor, what?
How do you address Shelton bringing up N. Ray grand jury investigation, which seems to be quite persuasive?
So in Shelton, the Court of Appeals recognized that there was this Third Circuit opinion. Now, first of all, it does not state we should follow this Third Circuit opinion in its totality, and indeed, this court can't, because the Third Circuit was addressing a federal common law privilege as opposed to Military Rule of Evidence 503. The only extent to which the court addressed that ruling was in finding that the privilege is not waived when a third party is related by blood and marriage and shares a commonality of purpose. And to go back to Judge Richardson's question earlier, that purpose in the communication must always relate back to one of the two privileged purposes within Military Rule of Evidence 503. So if their common purpose is not practicing a formal act of religion, and if their common purpose is not this communication to a clergy person as a matter of conscience, they do not share a commonality of purpose. In Shelton, the court looked at the fact that the wife specifically wanted the appellant to go and confess to his pastor. That's not what happened in this case. The family members did not want Apelli to confess to the chaplain. They wanted him to confess to them. So there is not a commonality of purpose under Military Rule of Evidence 503 in this case. Furthermore, he is not related by blood to his father-in-law, to his mother-in-law, or to his sister-in-law, or to his wife for that matter, and he certainly did not marry his father-in-law, his mother-in-law, or his sister-in-law. The military judge, again, failed to narrowly review the privilege and the terms of Military Rule of Evidence 503 and expanded a one-sentence line in Shelton to encompass any relation by marriage, not just that he is married, as the appellant in Shelton was, but that any person who then is connected to him through in-law status falls under that, and that's not the holding in Shelton. With that, Your Honors, I see that my time is nearly expired, and I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Appellee's counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Senior Judge Posh, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Captain David Bosner, and along with my co-counsel, Major Amanda Dermody, we represent Staff Sergeant Bryce Harris in this Article 62 appeal. Military judge did not abuse his discretion in concluding that the clergy privilege, one of the law's most sacred privileges, applies in this case. And under the highly deferential abuse of discretion standard, in reviewing the record in the light most favorable to Staff Sergeant Harris, military judge's findings of fact are supported by the record. His conclusions of law are correct, or at the very least, they are within the range of reasonable choices available at trial. And that's all that the law requires. Those conclusions of law are not an expansion of anything, but in fact, a faithful application of both MRE 503 and the binding case law on the military judge from United States versus Shelton. So with the court's permission, I'd like to start with discussing a matter of conscience. Now, as Judge McGinley noted, when comparing a matter of conscience to a formal act of religion, Shelton's language is privately held within a person, and that is a more subjective judicial determination than a formal act of religion. So as the core evidentiary nucleus of where this comes from, we look to whether Sergeant Harris believed that this was a matter of conscience, and he did. He testified that he was looking for guidance from the chaplain. He testified that this was a spiritual issue. And here's a fact that not only applies here, but actually applies to all three parts of the Shelton test, is that this meeting was originally offered or envisioned to go to a secular therapist or a mediator, but Sergeant Harris said, no, I want to go to the chaplain. And that's precisely because this meeting, the content of these communications, was religious and conscientious to Sergeant Harris. So the converse of that would be, if it were not religious or conscientious to him, he would have been more than satisfied with going to a secular therapist or counselor. But that was not the case, and we can look at that one fact, not just here, but at other places in the Shelton test as well. And it's not just whether he subjectively believed it and you leave it at its own. It would be proper for this court to review, and the military judge did, that not just did he subjectively believe it, but it was also objectively verifiable and reasonable based on the testimony of others. Principally, his wife testified. Record 28, also noted in Appellate Exhibit 4, Attachment 3. The wife said they went for spiritual reasons. And this wife is someone who, at the time of the motions hearing, likely would not have been on great terms with her ex-husband at the time, but she's providing objective, verifiable information to the court such that the military judge could reasonably conclude that this was a matter of conscience to Sergeant Harris, that he went for such a personal, subjective reason.
Are you saying that his wife at the time went for her own spiritual reasons, or that she said that husband went for his spiritual reasons?
Your Honor, both are correct. In the motions practice testimony, the wife testified that there were spiritual and religious reasons for her attendance, as well as she specifically noted the reason why he wanted to go was for his own spiritual reasons. The place in the record where that's most clear is Appellate Exhibit 4, which is a defense motion response, attachment 3. It's an excerpt from the report of investigation where the wife is saying he wanted to go to this meeting for spiritual reasons. That fact is an objective criterion, an objective piece of information that gives credence to his subjective belief that this is a matter of conscience and personally held to him. And at this point, this court can do precisely what the CAF did in United States versus Shelton, which is, if this court were to believe that this is a matter of conscience, that is enough to advance in the Shelton test without even determining whether the military judge abused his discretion as it pertains to it being a formal act of religion. Because the rule in the case law is clear that this is a disjunctive inquiry. If there is a matter of conscience, whether or not it's a formal act of religion is inconsequential. It's one or the other, and the CAF and Shelton only analyzed whether it was a matter of conscience.
Counsel, is what I'm hearing you say without saying it thus far is that in the opinion that we author, the matter of conscience is a pure question of fact, and it is not a mixed question of fact and law.
I don't believe so, sir. I think the government's counsel answer to the very same question is appropriate. There are factual underpinnings to the legal conclusion. And the factual underpinnings that I've stated start with the military judge recognizing Sergeant Harris testified, this is spiritual to me, this is religious to me, I'm looking for guidance. The factual underpinnings are that his wife acknowledged that this was spiritual and religious. Therefore, it is reasonable and appropriate to conclude as a matter of law that with that factual basis, this was a matter of conscience within the meaning of that term as far as we have a definition of it from our, as Your Honor mentioned, relatively thin case law on the subject matter. So I do believe it's a mixed question, and that both the facts and the law on this point to the Shelton test, as well as the rest, support our conclusion that the clergy privilege applies in this case. Now, to the extent the court would like to address whether or not this is a formal act of religion, government counsel noted that there's no evidence about which religion Sergeant Harris is formally a part of, and I respectfully disagree with that. The record is clear that he grew up in a Christian household. He went to a Christian academy. He attends church regularly, and he prays daily. That is evidence in the record from which the military judge concluded in his rulings that Sergeant Harris was formerly acting within the tenets of a non-denominational Christian religion at the time.
What is the tenet?
The tenet would be one of forgiveness, reconciliation, healing, and moving on. Now there is, although it's a disjunctive inquiry, there is some overlap with the matter of conscience, analysis, in that if something is inherently or internally conscientious to a person, it also may be implicated in the act done within the religion. And I believe that's the case in our case, which is if he is discussing things in this room, in this setting, for the purpose of getting it out in the open, forgiveness, reconciliation, moving on, that is fundamentally intertwined in his religious presentation in that room. Right? And I'd also like to address the government's point mentioned in their brief about whether or not the original purpose of the clergy privilege is satisfied in the military judge's finding that this is a formal act of religion. It would be far too narrow of a reading to determine that a Catholic confession or some type of penitence in that way is the only type of formal religion that could satisfy this part of the Shelton prong. And there are a variety of other privileges, and one, for instance, would be the spousal incapacity privilege, which has its origin in a wife not being a separate legal entity from the husband, and that medieval notion has far been disregarded by the law, but the spousal incapacity privilege still endures. So although there is a genesis in history from where this privilege comes from, that does not mean that other acts of religion could not constitute a formal act of religion in this case. And what we have is an admission or a confession for forgiveness, which under many religions is inherently important tenet of their religion, in a church with a chaplain, a member of the clergy, with the room closed, prayer was offered, religious material distributed. When we look at those facts, it is not an abuse of discretion for the military judge to have found anything that he did on the factual side. And to Senior Judge Posh's question, it is a faithful application of the standard from those facts to determine that this was a formal act of religion.
Counsel, I don't want to belabor this point, but I noticed in the Shelton case that, and I'm paraphrasing, the author judge at the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces seemed to say that they weren't going to we're not going to decide the issue on the basis of formal act of religion, and they went right to matter of conscience. Do you have any thoughts on this? Would there ever be a case, can you envision a scenario, whether it's this one or another one, where a statement or a communication would be a formal act of religion but would never meet the criteria for a matter of conscience? In other words, it would seem that arguably the language of formal act of religion would seem to be surplusage here, or maybe not.
Your Honor, I would say most often that formal act of religion could be subsumed within the matter of conscience, as you well note. What may distinguish it in a hypothetical scenario would be if an individual was acting within a tenet of a faith, but they didn't really personally, privately hold the belief, but they're doing it because their parents are making them go to a communion or something that effect. They could actually be doing something that constitutes a formal act of religion, but it's not something that's true to their conscience and true to their identity.
Thank you.
Moving on to the second part of the Shelton test, it's really broken down into two pieces. One is the chaplain there in her official capacity as a spiritual advisor, and two are the statements directed to the chaplain. Now, it's uncontested that the chaplain in this case meets the 503 definition for a member of the clergy, but she was also there in her official capacity. I go back to the one fact I mentioned in the last part of the test, which is Sergeant Harris said no to the secular mediator or therapist and yes to the chaplain because he wanted her there in her official capacity, and the chaplain testified that she was there in her official capacity. She was also there in the chapel in uniform.
That's an interesting point in the sense of this notion of official capacity versus being a spiritual advisor, because you could be in your official capacity but give financial advice or non-spiritual advice in this case. And so can you differentiate? I mean, did the appellee automatically get the privilege simply by virtue of her being in an official capacity, which seems to have a much broader connotation or role than one being simply as a spiritual advisor?
Judge McGinley, I think it's both in this case. She is there in her official capacity in the building she works with, which is the chapel in her uniform. That is the official capacity. But it's also there in the spiritual context. And we know this because she sat at the head of the table. There were opening remarks where all were quiet. She offered a prayer. She distributed religious literature. Sergeant Harris, on page 60 of the record, I think was cited earlier, he talks about the reason that he's going is for spiritual issues and guidance. And when we put those things together, we can see that the chaplain was there in a dual function, both as her official military capacity as a chaplain, but also there for that spiritual purpose to meet Sergeant Harris's purpose, which is forgiveness, which is unburdening himself, which is moving on with the family. So in this instance, it is both, although a situation could exist where a chaplain is there in her official capacity, but not a spiritual one, just like the analogy that Your Honor mentioned. I'd like to address the finding of fact that the military judge made that the statements were to the chaplain. As a starting point, it is not a correct recitation of the record to say that this was a communication from Sergeant Harris to the family, and the chaplain was a bystander. That's not a fair reading of the record. We have four people who testify about who was looking at who. We have Sergeant Harris, ER, the sister-in-law, and the mother-in-law. Now, the two most important people to this determination are Sergeant Harris and ER. And both of them testify he was primarily looking at the chaplain. And I can point to the record at 52 and 37, which is where the record demonstrates that Sergeant Harris was looking primarily at the chaplain when he talked. The other two people that mention who was looking at who is the wife. She initially testified that Sergeant Harris was looking at her sister, but then was later impeached by prior inconsistent statement that she had said to the defense in a pretrial interview that Sergeant Harris was looking at the chaplain. And we have the mother-in-law who said something different. So just on its face, we have a factual split. We have some people who say he was looking here, we have other people say he was looking here, and the military judge, grounded in the record, reasonably concluded, as a matter of fact, that he was looking at the chaplain. When you have the two people who are most critical to this determination, the declarant, Sergeant Harris, as well as the person who he otherwise was supposedly talking to, both say he's looking at the chaplain, it is reasonable for the military judge to have found as fact that he was looking to the chaplain. And almost we take a step back and just look at having competing sets of factual information presented in motions testimony. It almost by definition cannot be an abuse of discretion for the military judge to have gravitated towards one set of that information. And he concluded that the
counsel in the judge's second ruling, his finding of fact, is that the accused looked primarily at both ER and the chaplain. Which is not what you're arguing. You're arguing that the judge found that he was looking primarily at the chaplain. Here, how does this fact that the judge found help us at all?
So
he was looking primarily at both.
Yes, Your Honor, two responses. First is the military judge did find as fact that Sergeant Harris was looking primarily at two different places, and that is an absolutely permissible conclusion, just in the way that I am addressing all three judges on this panel at the same time. It cannot be said that I'm no less talking to Your Honor Judge Richardson as I'm talking to Judge McGinley at the same time. So to the extent that Sergeant Harris is there talking amongst people in his presence, it is absolutely appropriate for those words to be directed in multiple places. And to the second point, Judge Richardson, I wanted to identify those two places in the record that do demonstrate that Sergeant Harris had eye contact and was looking at the chaplain. And why that's important is because if, as a finding of fact, it's grounded in the record, and this court reviews it for abuse of discretion, that he was looking to the chaplain, the natural legal conclusion from that fact is that the second part of the Shelton test is satisfied, that he was talking to the chaplain in her spiritual capacity at this time. And further on this point of who's looking at who, I would argue that this eye contact test is first of all hardly developed in this case, but if we were to have that as the standard going forward, that if there was one confidential communication setting where a declarant had a permissible third party present as envisioned by MRE 503 and Shelton, and that person was really the purpose, or their presence was necessary for the transmission or disclosure to them was in furtherance of the purpose, but to also hold that they couldn't engage with that person and necessarily had to talk through the clergy member in order to really direct the unburdening towards that third party, it would be defeating to the purpose of the privilege, in so much as we see MRE 503 permits third parties to be there.
All right, so I'm going to pose to you the same question I posed to the government, because I think that's what you're touching on, which is, what does that mean in 503? When the disclosure is in furtherance of the purpose of the communication, is the purpose, as the government said, relate back to the formal act of religion or matter of conscience, or is the purpose the goal of the meeting, to heal the family or some other goal? What is it?
Your Honor, it does relate back to the matter of conscience or formal act of religion, as the military judge found. So government counsel's answer to that question I share is that if disclosure to that person is in furtherance of the purpose, that purpose does relate back to whether it's a matter of conscience, this unburdening, this forgiveness. And the military judge devoted a portion of his ruling, more so in the ruling on the motion for reconsideration, that he talks about how these people are there, the family members are there for forgiveness, reconciliation, and moving on. So it is connected in that this privately held subjective matter of conscience to Sergeant Harris, as it's divulged, as it gets aired, the consequence of that releasing from him may necessarily be forgiveness, reconciliation, and the family moving on. So just because there is a consequence, as you mentioned in the question, of forgiveness and moving on, it's not determinative to whether or not they're there for the purpose of the communication. We also look to, as we've now moved into the confidentiality part of the Shelton test, the first point I like to make about that is we look to whether the communicator intended that this is confidential. Sergeant Harris testified that he thought it was 100% confidential. And also, as I mentioned in the matter of conscience section, there are other objective criteria in the record that demonstrate his subjective belief of confidentiality is objectively verified. Everyone else who contemplated the matter also believed it was confidential. The chaplain did, the wife did, the dad did. We're also in a room.
What did they think was confidential? Right, the government was not at trial, is not gonna call Chaplain David as a witness. So the clergy person herself isn't being asked to testify. So when these witnesses testified that they believed it was confidential, did they just mean that nobody else in the room was going to get to talk about it to anybody else outside the room? Or did they mean the clergy person wasn't going to be able to disclose or something else? What does confidential mean in this?
Confidential would mean anything that's spoken inside that room. One piece of testimony I like to point to is the father-in-law. He's called for a very short purpose.
Right, he talks about it being private.
And he uses the word private, which I think gives more context to this is a private matter within this family, such that we're not going to parse out between individuals who's speaking to who, and that would be protected. But when you're talking to the other side of the room, that would not be protected. This holistic environment was intended to be private and confidential. And as Shelton acknowledges, this starts with what's the communicator's intent. And it's clear in the record that Sergeant Harris believed this is confidential. And to the extent that other people talk about their understandings, this court reviews those only for objective verification that what Sergeant Harris believed was reasonable under the circumstances. And in this case, it was. On the point of confidentiality, we've touched on it a little bit, whether third parties present in this room vitiate the attachment of the privilege. One thing I mentioned in the written filing is there is a distinction to be made between waiver that we see in MRE 510 and in CAF cases such as Jasper that talk about disclosure after the fact such that further invocation of the privilege would be inappropriate, and whether privilege attaches in this case at the moment of the disclosure. And the latter is really what's relevant in our case. MRE 503, within the definition of confidential, identifies that third parties can be present and not disrupt the confidentiality. Shelton also acknowledges that third parties can be present and not disrupt the attachment of the privilege. The two analyses are similar, but they are a bit distinct. Shelton looks at whether there's a blood or marriage relationship.